When observing these maneuvers in Kursk, he wrote and expressed that he was sorry she couldn't be there with him, that he really wished that she could be there to enjoy what he called the good, healthy feelings and sense of inner calm that he was enjoying being with the army. And there are many letters like this. And pay attention to this particular and really very important political psychology. Calm and pleasure through the rituals of tradition and order and discipline and, of course, military might. This was all part of that one side of Russia's political, cultural tradition, the ideal of the Grozny Tsar, which Nicholas completely embraced. Now, to be sure, all of this can be seen as simply matters of personality, but they were also personal values and, by extension, shaped his ideas about fundamental questions of society and politics. These values, personal though they seem to be, but rooted in a political tradition, helped shape policy in Russia. Simply put, in all areas of life, he believed, all people, whether at work or in their relations with other people, should be guided by the very same virtues. They should live a life marked by order and self-discipline and regularity. And of course, he believed strongly that the autocratic state was the key to making sure that everybody in all areas of life lived in just this stable way. For him, this was a matter of virtue. And we see these same ideas in the very concrete realm of policy. For example, in his persistent rejection of talk about political freedom and democracy. To him, these were matters of disorder, as they were for his tutor, of course, Konstantin Pobedonostsev. For example, when he came to the throne in 1896, his formal coronation, he made his first public address, probably written for him, by the way, by Pobedonostsev himself, who we talked about last time. And he, in this speech, with representatives of society gathered before him, he spoke about widespread talk in society about a constitution as, in his words, nothing but senseless dreams. Shocking many how brunt, how brutal he was in rejecting these as something not even worth dreaming about. Later, when the country erupted in revolution in 1905, when those senseless dreams of democracy became for Nicholas in some ways a nightmare, and this is a story I will tell next time, he agreed to create, under a great deal of pressure, a legislature and to grant civil rights. Within a couple of years, though, he began to regret his weakness at that moment. And he did everything he could to undo those policies, which we'll describe next time, of granting some measure of constitutional power to people and some measure of civil rights. He rewrote the electoral laws to ensure that disloyal groups were less visible in the Duma, the legislative body that was created by the revolution, workers and people from the cities. He limited the power of the legislature over all aspects of society, especially their power over the military. And above all, he reserved for the government the right, often exercised, to abrogate civil rights, protect internal security whenever he felt necessary. In every respect, he believed in the importance of the power of autocracy and using it to preserve order. In fact, his personal reactions to disorder, in particular the strikes and demonstrations that began quite commonly in Russia from the 1890s, are revealing. This is particularly evident in his response to the revolution of 1905, the history of which I'll describe next time. But listen to his reaction to it. He says, "It makes me sick to read the news. Nothing but strikes in schools and factories, murdered policemen and Cossacks and soldiers, riots, disorder, mutinies everywhere." He said what's needed is quick decision, ruthless action, a strong and steady hand. No less telling are that in his many statements about the disorder of public protests, he declared that it was really more even a disgrace and a shame that such disorder should exist than it was a political threat. He seemed more concerned by the moral harm, the moral shame of such actions in his society than by what a threat they really posed to him. Now, of course, there's another side to Russia's and Nicholas II's political culture. And this is the idea that you've heard about before, well established in Russian tradition, the idea of the Tsar as Tishaishi, as a ruler united in love and harmony with his devoted people, as saintly, as pious, as the Tsar father, Tsar Batyushka. And in fact, Nicholas II also devoted a great deal of effort to publicly expressing this ideal. And he found in these public rituals of his bonds with the people confirmation of his faith. They too were deeply meaningful to him. For example,